Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of this conversation, and I'm pleased to be speaking with Jennifer Domino Rudolph, author of Baseball as Mediated Latinidad, Race, Masculinity, Nationalism, and Performances of Identity, published by Ohio State University Press in 2020 as part of the Global Latin and Latino Americas series, edited by Frederick Luis Aldama and Lourdes Torres. Jennifer Domino Rudolph is Associate Professor of Hispanic Studies at Connecticut College. She teaches classes in Latinx studies on topics related to Latinx popular culture, media, and Spanish for heritage speakers. Her current research focuses on representations and receptions of Latino and Latinx masculinities in media and popular culture. Hello, Jennifer, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here and share my work.
Great, thank you. I'm super excited to have you on because I'm particularly going through withdrawals in that baseball season has not started.
I think we all are.
Right, but I'm anxiously awaiting games towards the end of this month. So I was hoping we can just start, maybe you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and maybe if you could just toss in at some point who your favorite baseball team and player is.
Oh, well, actually, I am from Chicago, so that's always a tough question because my mother's family, actually, when they arrived from Italy to Chicago, they settled very close to where the Chicago White Sox play on the south side. And so White Sox games were always on in the background when I was growing up. And my mother was a very big fan. In fact, my grandmother would tell these stories about how they would actually put a chair out in front of their house to guard their parking space on game days so that fans didn't park and take their space. And so that's just always been there in my life. And then growing up, ironically, my best friend's family took me to many, many Cubs games. So I've actually been to Wrigley Field more times than I have been to Sox Park. I refuse to call it Guaranteed Rate Field. Just not into that. And actually people from the neighborhood call it Sox Park. That's kind of what it's known. And so that's where really my interest in this topic began, because baseball was always around in my life. And people say this is going to sound like a cop-out, but I have a love for the White Sox and the Cubs in different ways. Like, there's aspects of both teams that I like, and picking one of them is hard. And whenever they play each other, it's always tough, because like I'm kind of rooting for both. And then all my friends are like, "You have to pick. You can't stay neutral." But I do love and root for both teams. And I'm suffering in the East Coast because I know disrespect, but I'm not a Yankees person. I'm not a Red Sox person, because in Connecticut, people are either typically Yankees or Red Sox. And no disrespect, but no, I just follow Chicago as best I can from afar. So yeah.
That's awesome. Thanks for sharing that. I won't take it as a cop-out. I can understand, dual loyalties and stuff like that. So I appreciate that. And how about a little bit more about yourself, maybe how you came into academia, et cetera?
Yeah, I basically, my academic journey was just that professors in college just kept encouraging me to go on. They just kept saying, like, I didn't really know, my family's sort of very working class, so I didn't really know what a PhD was or grad school or things like that, or like, let alone having a research career and teaching in higher ed. And so professors just along the way, especially my advisor from undergrad, Olga Vileña Jainero, who is Puerto Rican, encouraged me. She was like, no, I think this is something that you could really do and you really should do. So she kind of mentored me, encouraged me to go on to graduate school. And now here I am, however many years later, more than I'd like to think about.
I love hearing stories like that, because I just get the impression that so many of my students who I've spoken with in the past just kind of think like all of us professors are cut out of the same mold, you know, like we come from academic families or pedigrees and stuff like that. And for so many of my colleagues and myself, it wasn't like that. There's nothing wrong having that happen, right? It's just only kind of natural. I mean, like my parents were educators in the primary education level. And so I always kind of anticipated maybe going to education. But as you mentioned, yeah, it wasn't, for me, this was never a thought until professors and mentors actually put it into my mind that it's something you could actually do, right?
Yeah, I was going to be a high school Spanish teacher for a very long time. And then my advisor's like, you could do that, but you could do this.
Right. Well, I'm sure you would have been a phenomenal high school Spanish teacher as well. And so that's great. Well, to get talking a little bit about the book, I was hoping if you could, wouldn't mind just explaining the title for us a little bit. What does that actually mean? In particular, the first part of it, baseball as mediated Latinidad.
Yes, and I know that's a bit of a long, one of the things about academic books is titles can tend to be long, but this idea of baseball as mediated Latinidad, I kind of had two goals for the idea of mediated here, meaning both baseball is a way I think that people use to mediate how they understand Latinos and their place in U.S. society. And I mean, not only Latinos themselves, but also non-Latinos, because given baseball's demographics, which we can get more into in a few minutes, this is a critical mass of Latinos that people see playing baseball. And so this is a way, a space for people to make meaning of this population and to kind of, you know, make sense of where they place in the United States, and also just issues around nationality, citizenship, and race, and all of these things come into play, and particularly because baseball is entirely men, masculinity. And so baseball, as I said, becomes a place for people to, the mechanism by which maybe we could say people mediate this, their understanding of Latinidad. And then for fans, for Latino fans, following players can become tied with things like nationality. For example, certain teams in the Dominican Republic have like certain followings specifically in the United States, like fans of a certain Dominican team will tend to be fans of certain U.S. teams because of the connections there or because specific players. I mean, obviously the Red Sox very much benefited from Papi Ortiz and Manny Ramirez and Pedro Martinez, who we referred to as the Holy Trinity at one point, La Santa Trinidad in the Dominican community. And so, you know, you saw us, a huge spike in fans of the Boston Red Sox during that time. Sammy Sosa brought a lot of Dominicans and Latinos to the Cubs. You know, we could go on with many examples, and I think more and more, because as I said, if anything, the number of Latino American players is only increasing. And I just want to say quickly, when I say Latino American, I do the Latino American because I want to include both Latinos that were born in the U.S., which is actually less of the MLB player population, because most of them were born in Latin America and either came to the U.S. in childhood or were recruited directly through the Dominican, particularly academia system, where a lot of recruitment happens. And so just to make sure that both of those groups are kind of accounted for, because we don't necessarily separate them when we think about baseball players. And sometimes you don't even know who was born in the U.S., who was born abroad. We don't know what people's specific biographies are. And so that was the idea of this, of the mediated use in one sense. But then also I wanted to point to the media specifically, because the media is obviously where most people consume baseball and also consume information about players. Like this is where people learn about, you know, what players do in their off times. Either they follow them on social media or through, you know, or through coverage in newspapers, magazines, and on team websites and such. So this idea of mediated can have both the media, but also like this mechanism to understand kind of the meaning. And in terms of the long bottom part of the title, the race, masculinity, nationalism, and performances of identity, that those are sort of like the main things I wanted to look at. And the main aspects of Latino identity that I think baseball really brings to the table and can help us understand more widely as, you know, as a country and just as both as fans, but also media workers who do this and who present this information as well, who have a responsibility that they don't always sort of, that they kind of shirk, I think, sometimes in the way that they represent players and sort of just kind of the messages that they send to fans through some of the media coverage. So that was where that came from.
Thank you for breaking that down a bit. And even for me, listening to it again after reading the book, it helps me to see the way, you know, that the title is working with this phrasing in several ways. The first is that came clearly to me initially was that baseball is like a medium, right? It's like a frame that helps make Latinos intelligible in some way, right, for better or worse, right, to a public, a certain segment of the public that isn't really familiar with who Latinos are outside of what they see on the screen, right? And so as America's pastime, right, this game, which has a large white audience, I don't know, you probably know the numbers a lot more than I do, but particularly in regards to demographics, it's one of the sports that still has a very large white male audience, right?
Yep, it sure does.
And so we can presume that there's a lot of that large white male audience that doesn't really come into contact with Latinos all that much. And maybe baseball is one of the primary means to which that happens. So as you're saying, the way that they're represented through the media, on the screen, the way they're described in the broadcast, et cetera, the way they act, all that is somehow making it comprehensible to viewers who and what Latinos are, right? And then the other way that I really like that you pointed out too is that, but this doesn't just work one way, right? Those unfamiliar with Latinos, but for a Latino audience themselves, whether they're US born Latinos or Latin American, right? Immigrants, right? There is a, by viewing these players on, you know, TV, it can build a sense of Latinidad, right? It can build a sense of community or idea of who Latinos are as this big pan-ethnic community, right? That's made up of, you know, Afro-Latinos and, you know, other, you know, Latinos from, you know, various parts, right, of the Americas, whether they're Mexican, Caribbean, Venezuelan, whatever it may be, right? Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, for Latinos themselves, this can build a sense of, hey, like, we are something, right? Like as a bigger group beyond our national affinity.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then your aspect in the media, which I think is really important. So thank you for breaking that down. And I just really enjoy how that works. And then again, with the race, masculinity, nationalism, these are kind of all things that are, how these things are all constructed, right? Through that sense of Latinidad. So what is race, right? So how does, you know, this notion of Latinidad, what does it mean to be Latino? How does that affect our conceptions of race, right? When you see a Spanish-speaking ball player that looks black, mm-hmm. right? That may be a big shock to people. Or when you see someone, conversely, that has the last name Gonzalez, right? And speaks perfect English, you know, and mm-hmm. seems very middle class or whatever, right? This can... all these things have an effect on how we understand these things like race, what it means to be, you know, a Latino male in terms of masculinity, or how nationalism intersects with this broad pan-ethnic transnational concept, right?
Absolutely.
All right, good. Okay, so thanks for that. I wanted to delve a bit more into this now as we particularly look at, I want to bring up back up the concept of, you know, baseball as America's pastime, right? That has this large, you know, white male and broadly white audience. And it is much more diverse than that, but that may be the largest segment of it. And so what does it mean, right, to have a substantial chunk, right, of almost, well, it's a little more than a quarter of the professional ball players, I think it's something like 27%, I think the book pulls out, right, that are Latino, particularly from the Caribbean and Venezuela, right? A lot of them looking clearly, as Americans would read them, as Black, right? So like, what does this do for conceptions about, you know, the U.S., the U.S. race relations and that kind of history and like U.S. nationalism as, right, fans are literally consuming, right, entertainment and a product that is tied to America so closely in building American nationalism as, you know, a white Protestant thing and particularly like English monolingual thing. But then you have these figures on the field who you're celebrating and cheering that don't fit that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will start with actually a personal anecdote that I actually opened my first chapter, which is on Sammy Sosa, with this. When he played, because I think that this sort of everyday example gets to exactly what you're saying. And it's a great window into what fans are thinking when they're consuming a game. I was watching a Cubs game with my sister in the early 2000s when Sammy was still playing. And, you know, I'll say my sister's kind of average American-ish, I would say, whatever that means. But by that, I mean she doesn't have much knowledge about Latinos and race like I do. In fact, she looks to me for when she has questions about that. And so during this very game, she looked at me and said, "So is Sammy Sosa Hispanic or Black?" And I said, "Well, if you asked him, he would tell you he's Dominican." And she looked at me like, that wasn't one of the options that I presented to you in my question. And I said, Dominicans don't identify that way. That's a U.S. racial construct, you know, this idea of Black or Hispanic, which then I didn't get into the weeds of the fact that Hispanic would actually be considered an ethnic identity and as opposed to a race identity, because people who are identified as Latino or Hispanic can be both anything from light to can be from white to Black, and complexions vary and such. But this idea, I think, of identifying nationally but not racially, I think is something that a lot of people in the United States struggle with. And so I then asked a very good friend of mine who's from the Dominican Republic, and I said, you know, that's how I answered the question. I told my sister that Sammy would identify as Dominican. Would you agree, as someone who grew up there? And she said, absolutely. She's like, and I'll tell you, he would probably not identify as Negro. And we were talking about like the racial categories that exist in the Dominican Republic. And that she said that probably he would be not likely to publicly identify as Negro, that he might say something like Indio Oscuro, which Dominican culture uses to emphasize the indigenous heritage and downplay the African heritage of Dominicans due to sort of the racial history and the relationship with Haiti that country has. And so, you know, my sister, of course, had no idea of the can of worms that she was opening and asking that question. But I think that speaks to the degree to which many Americans who are not familiar with Latino culture, like you said, when they look at the bodies playing baseball that they see, and they certainly would not understand them from a racial perspective in the same way that a Latino fan would, or someone in Latin America. If we can stay with Sammy Sosa for a minute, I think he's important, and this is why I dedicated an entire chapter to his story. I don't know if people listening to this will remember, on November 5th, 2009, Sammy Sosa showed up at the Latin Grammys with very lightened skin. Like, it was visibly much, much lighter than his skin had ever been. And of course, people were wondering what the heck was going on, and all of these like memes with pictures of him from early in his career to then comparing his skin tone, and all of the speculation around what that meant and why that was started to happen. And so Sosa's publicist and sort of his promotional camp, their official explanation was that he was using a facial cream to soften his skin and to also even out his complexion because he suffers from vitiligo, was sort of what people, that was like the official Sammy Sosa narrative of what was going on there. But this also, and whether that's true or not, although most dermatologists, and actually a few dermatologists were quoted in press articles saying that would unlikely be the case, that really did not sound like an actual explanation for that. But the actual explanation aside, because I think what's really more important is what happened around Sammy Sosa, receptions of him and what fans and popular culture creators did with that, because this opens up a huge, you know, further conversation about how race is understood among Latinos and Latino Americanos. So there's a whole debate about, you know, about blackness and where does that fit in Dominican ancestry. And so you saw everything from fans talking, basically shaming Sammy Sosa and saying, listen, you're black and you need to own that. And you're doing a total disservice to Dominicans by lightening yourself and by trying to distance yourself from blackness. And then on the other end of the scale, were unfortunately some horribly, just horribly shaming posts on social media about how black, just defaming blackness and saying that Sammy Sosa was doing the right thing, you know, distancing himself from blackness, that blackness is something that people should avoid at all costs. And so you had like those two polls, but then you had people posted things that were sort of between that. Like one particular blogger referred to what Sammy Sosa was doing in terms of distancing himself from blackness as, and I'm quoting here, the mulatto escape hatch. And I want to say that we need to be careful because the term mulatto is very racialized, very negatively racialized in the United States in a way that it isn't necessarily all over Latin America. But I bring this up because what this person argued in coining and using that term was that, you know, what a lot of Dominicans like Sammy Sosa might be tempted to do, and Latin Americans in general, because of the history, of the fraught history around African heritage in Latin America, is instead of identifying as black, they'll identify as mixed race, as a combination of whiteness and blackness, so as to downplay the African heritage. And this goes back to thinkers like Jose Vasconcelos with La Raza Cosmica in Mexico and others who, you know, talked about this idea that Latin Americans, and in the case of Vasconcelos specifically, Mexicans had indigenous blood as well as Spanish blood and black blood, but these things were all not necessarily living together in a harmonious way. And I think that in terms of coming to a reckoning with race, and I would say this is, if not, I would say it may be even more true in the United States, especially seeing what we're seeing right now in terms of the uprisings and protests around police brutality. But what this basically is showing us is that neither Latin America nor the United States has really reckoned with its racial identity. And so this was an opportunity for us to see kind of in real time with the example of a real person, how people were understanding this and negotiating it and sort of identifying racially. And the last thing I'll say about this, and if people have not checked this out, and if you speak Spanish, I highly recommend you Googling this. There's a merengue song, La Crema de Sammy Sosa, by Nelson de la Hoya, and it is a hysterical, I mean, aspects of it are obviously very sad because it basically is him saying, you know, like being black is all of the quote unquote problems or issues with being black. And so, but it's also done in an incredibly humorous way. And of course, there's a gesturing to Michael Jackson in the song, because we know that Michael Jackson has historically sort of did the same thing. And so the other thing that I would highly recommend is a skit that came out in the show Arre con Miguel Raymond, where Raymond also is a Dominican comedian, dresses, he and his partner, they dress as Sammy Sosa and his wife. And so and they're supposed to be interviewed on a Miami news station. And what's really interesting about that sort of staged interview is that basically the gist of the narrative is that he becomes addicted to this crema because he wants everything to be white and he wants everything to be light. But the problem is that now that he's no longer playing baseball, he doesn't have enough money to keep sort of buying these cremas that he needs. And so he and his wife are trying to figure out how that's going to work, or if maybe he should just use her face products. So there's some interesting gender things, especially too, you can let your imagination go with you around the idea of crema and how crema is used to signify different substances from facial creams to bodily fluids. And I'll leave it at that. But even within this conversation about this need for whitening and how, you know, having money and having capital makes you whiter, there's definitely a consideration that he should remain black in the words of his wife, where it counts, which is sort of like his male parts. And so this idea, even like wealth, is so strongly equated with whiteness, but virility and masculinity and strength throughout the interview is equated with blackness. And so I think that is a great example of how just the nuanced just how nuanced the conversations we have around race are and how that intersects with things like gender and things like social class. So that's why I started with the chapter on Sammy Sosa. And he has been recently, in 2018, he was in Where Are They Now? Issue of ESPN magazine. He's on the cover and he says that he's still with a very lightened complexion. He now lives in Dubai and he says he will no longer talk about the lightening of his skin, that he is happy and he's not anti-Black, but he's happy with himself as he is right now. And that everybody should just leave him alone. And that, you know, he's the one that wins because he's living this wealthy lifestyle in Dubai. And so, you know, basically it's basically kind of like, leave me alone and we're not going to talk about this anymore.
Right. Yeah. And I really enjoyed it too. I enjoyed how you started with the personal anecdote, right? And that story, because it is something that, I don't know, I think several of our listeners and I think just people can relate to, whether those are questions we have ourselves when we come into contact with someone that we can't quite read, you know, legibly, like racially or culturally or something like that. It's something that people can relate to, right? And particularly baseball provides these type of interactions and conversations, you know, almost on a nightly basis during, you know, baseball season, right? When a new kid comes up, a new ball player, pelotero, comes out of the farm league system, you know, and, you know, maybe he looks Black, but then he's got that Guzman last name or whatever it may be, automatically it starts to trigger these type of debates and conversations. And I think you're right. Sammy Sosa presents a very good figure, one that a lot of people can relate to. Again, he was, you know, in the home run chase, you know, back in the early 2000s, right? And you do talk about that. And I always kind of caught that. This was before my academic years, but I could kind of see the kind of racial undertones that are going beyond that. Like, who was cheering for McGuire, right, to break the record, and who wanted Sosa to break the record, you know? And it wasn't just a Black-white frame, right? It's not like there's just, it was McGuire's the white guy and Sosa's the Black guy, but Sosa was foreign, you know? And so, so to some people, right? He's not even American, right? I just caught a bit of that, you know, even as a younger adult, that wasn't so at that point really into studying racial analysis. And I tried to remember, I tried to think back in my own mind, like, who was I rooting for at that time? And, you know, I remember I really liked Sammy. I just liked his kind of, I think it maybe came down to like more of a batting stance and style, right? And we can get into this later on, the style at which he played. You know, McGuire was always much more stoic, you know, and I remember McGuire from his early years too, when both of them were much smaller, right?
Absolutely. And that was another thing, like several pictures of Sammy have surfaced over time. Like, look at how small he was then and how like just corporeally larger he is for the end of his career. Absolutely. Yeah.
And the same thing with McGuire, right? I mean, McGuire becomes like barrel chested, you know, like humongous in his, right, at the end of his, towards the latter parts of his career when he was a stick figure at the beginning. So it is cool. We can get into steroids and all that later. I think that's a fascinating part of it too. But yeah, definitely, you know, this, and I think what really comes out, right, is this idea of, you know, baseball, it may be America's pastime, right? America as in U.S. America, but it belongs to the Americas, right?
Definitely.
And it is a transnational sport, and it has been one for, you know, since its beginning, as you point out, and other authors point out. And, you know, baseball and its audience and the media, right, are still coming to terms with this, right?
Absolutely.
And discussions about race and masculinity around figures like Sosa is just one way where we can see that come very clearly and very tangibly, right?
Right. And if I could just jump in here for a second in terms of MLB in the fan base situation, I mean, for a long time, the joke was that MLB fans are basically aging out because the biggest, as you said, the biggest sort of fan cluster group is middle to upper, middle aged to older white men. And so, you know, like the elder ones, obviously passing away. And what MLB, I think, and you can see this, I think, in some of the initiatives like the Ponle Acento case that I talk about in the book that we could talk about in a minute if you'd like. I think what they show us is that I think MLB is starting to realize this. And there was actually one of the articles that I quoted in the book that was on, it's escaping me right now which Latino Facebook page it was on, but it was definitely out of the Latino press that was saying, you know what, Latinos are going to, if baseball is going to survive, Latinos are going to make it survive. Like, they're going to make it happen. And so that will also, which I think is true. And I think MLB, like I said, is starting to come to that realization as well. But I think that if in order for that to be the case, and going back to what you said about the sort of white Anglo-Protestant culture of masculinity around MLB, that's going to have to change, because I'm sure you've seen it and you kind of gestured to it when you talked about Sammy's batting stance. This idea, there's often criticism that Latino players are too flashy, like either in their batting stances or like when they're doing their home run trots, like there's all these conversations about showing up the pitcher and, you know, like expressing too much emotion on the field. But then, you know, several Latino players have come out and said, but that's how we play the game. And other than that, it's boring. Like, why would we not do that? And so I think, but these also then, I think, are tensions that, depending on your positionality as a fan of Major League Baseball, you read through that lens. Like, for maybe for a lot of like old school white guys, like my father probably would say, that's flashy. You know, a gentleman just drops the bat, runs the four bases and takes care of it. And that's it. Whereas younger people who come from different backgrounds might say, no, you know, I think players should be allowed to show some of their personality on the field. And I remember growing up during Sammy, because I was like you, a lot of the Sammy Sosa years, I was not an academic yet. So like, and that was interesting in writing that chapter, because I was thinking back about, you know, growing up with him around in Chicago, because he was in the media so much. And one of the things that he was criticized for a lot was like sort of the kissing up to the sky and that was, you know, that he said was something that he was doing for his mother, and just that he was considered by the Chicago media as being very, very much a show off or being arrogant in sort of the way that he carried his body. And I think that was read as something that was definitely attached to some of the stereotypes of Latino masculinities that we could name, like being too passionate or being irrational. And so, yeah.
Yeah, no, certainly. I mean, a guy that just brings up so many memories, my dad and I and just other people I know, we've had so many conversations about this, like when I just growing up, or at least just the comments of, yes, the type of performative aspect and style, right? Mm-hmm. Everything from a bat flip to a trot to a batting stance to, yeah, you know, the kissing and the peace sign to the sky that, you know, I just loved it when Sammy would do that. I mean, I wasn't even a Cubs fan growing up, but I forgot to mention I'm a Dodger fan, but I'm actually wearing my hat.
History, I can definitely approve of you being a Dodger fan. Fernando Media all the way.
That's right. In fact, I got a Fernando Media Twitter jersey behind me.
Love it.
But yeah, definitely. So many of these, it's so funny. And what the thought was coming to my mind is that I don't think there's like, we don't realize the racial undertones, at least I didn't, right? As a teenager, as a kid, or even, you know, till I started like reading, you know, academic works on this subject,
right?
That, you know, all those things about what's the appropriate way to act, right?
Mm-hmm.
As an athlete, we hear this in football too, right?
Yes.
You know, whether someone overly celebrates in, you know, an end zone, that has become something that was, you know, attributed to African-American players.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember when Ken Griffey Jr., right, in with his batting stance and the kind of little waving of the bat, or when he turned his baseball cap backwards, right, in the home run contest, it got like so much media attention because that was like something new, right? And what they're saying is like, this was urban and black is how it was being read.
Yep.
This is not white, right? This is not, you know, like gentlemanly like conduct, right?
Exactly.
And yeah, it's just, it's full of racial undertones. And I think you're right in regards to, you know, MLB, you know, there's been a lot of commentary, right? They have an aging, again, demographic with white males. They've kind of missed the boat or dropped the ball. And not missed the boat, they dropped the ball, right, on kind of like their urban initiatives or, you know, trying to recruit and do something about, African-Americans and how to retain them and bring them into the game and all that. So, you know, whereas NBA and football has kind of made that turn. I mean, you just see this right now with Goodell, like all of a sudden they're embracing Black Lives Matter. I'm like,
and yet still problematic about Colin Kaepernick. So
yeah.
Okay, Goodell. I don't know.
But baseball has this, you know, this stronger reluctance, right, to go that route. They haven't gone there yet, right? And I think in even ways of, I see just parallels with politics, like the way politicians yes. take advantage of Latinos, right? It's kind of like the way, mm-hmm. I get that sense, that's how MLB is working with Latinos right now. They're kind of thinking like, where else are they going to go? We got mm-hmm. them anyways. We need to expand our market share into these other areas, mm-hmm. right? Rather than saying, oh, here's a key demographic and a key way that we can really, you know, expand our market share. And, you know, there's that hesitancy to do that. Mm-hmm. And as you point out in the book, so much of that is tied to, you know, the identity of baseball as a white, right, again, Protestant American thing. Like American being identified as white Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
Yes.
There's this reluctance to move away from that, right?
Definitely. Go ahead. Oh, I was going to say, and I think this is where the Pone Acento example yes, might be great, because
that's exactly where I was going to go with language in Spanish.
Yes,
next
because, and if you look, as I, of course I watched, so for the background of our listeners, this was a campaign that MLB did in 2016 with the Houston-based Latino ad agency called Latin Works. And it, for Hispanic Heritage Month, the idea was that they would encourage, that MLB would encourage players to add the accent marks to the last names on their uniform as sort of a show of pride during Hispanic Heritage Month and reconnection with their identity. But when you, if you Google, because the, and I had never seen the ad campaign on TV, but I watched it on Google. There's a sort of a commercial slash pitch for the ad. And what's, and I think this is to your point about the way that MLB is trying to deal with race in a way that I think they may think is a little bit less polemic than engaging in something like blackness, because what they do is it's very much through a narrative of immigration, but like a very deserving immigration, not like an undocumented immigration, because of course they would not want to, although that's an issue in MLB in terms of recruitment with Cuban players, but that's a separate issue. But so at the beginning of this ad, like you, it opens up and there's a passport, and the last name on the passport is Calderon, which has an accent on the O in Spanish typically, but it's not there. And so the voiceover, which has an accent that would be associated with Spanish being the person's first language, you know, he talks about how the identities have been stripped from many people's last names as they came to the United States and got a U.S. passport because the accent mark is missing from their names. And then you see like all of these players' uniforms with like the accent coming on top, like Ramirez on the I, or like Rodriguez on the I, or, you know, any number of ones we could say as examples. But, you know, this idea of recovering this sort of lost heritage. And ironically too, then there, it flips to a shot of a sewing machine in a hand, like sewing the accent back atop someone, the vowel in somebody's uniform. And I mean, for me, that's a really ironic image, because if we look at like garment workers in New York City for such a long time, particularly like Puerto Rican women, were very strongly recruited into that labor source. So I'm not sure if they did that intentionally to sort of make a gesture to a different labor source other than baseball, where there was a lot of Latinx recruitment, at least in the early 20th century. But so, you know, you kind of see how they're definitely going through this, like, you know, the quote unquote good immigrant who has come to the United States to make a better life. And we've robbed them of certain aspects of their identity by robbing them of the accent mark. And so then MLB for that month on the MLB logo, which is, you know, the batter and kind of in his stance with the ball coming toward him, they put an accent mark on top of the bat. And so the reason I think that this is problematic is because it's like totally superficial. I mean, this is very much one sort of superficial and exotifying narrative of immigration, I think. And so I think this is, and I think for MLB, this is like, they thought they were really going very far in doing this. I think they were probably like, wow, you know, we're really embracing Latinidad here. And I just don't think it rings as too much more than like, part of this is my training and background, but I have a feeling that most people would probably agree. I think it just reads as a very superficial attempt to shamelessly garner more Latino fans without putting in the work to do it, and without maybe making them feel more comfortable, maybe making the ballparks more hospitable. Because even in recent years, there's been a lot of incidences around, particularly in Fenway Park, around players, Black players and Latino American players being called racial slurs, like as they're standing in the outfield in their positions, especially, you know, around like the Green Monster. And so, you know, I think when we see the reality of what's happening, and then, you know, this little commercial about immigrants and needing to recover the accent, it sounds lovely, but I think it rings hollow.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I can totally see that as well. And it was Andrew Jones. Was that the most recent incidence of an African American player being heckled with racial taunts at Fenway Park?
I think so. I have to double check because I do have that in the book somewhere, but I think that's right.
Yeah, but yeah, no, I agree. I mean, as much as I love seeing the accent on the jerseys. I agree. And particularly as you were talking, I was thinking about like that label immigrant, mm-hmm. Imposing the label of immigrant on people that may not have that. Right. I mean,
exactly.
I've learned that like with my students, mm-hmm. in talking to them, I have students from Latin America, and one, in a class discussion last year, just shared how kind of almost offensive and like shocked she was that people called her an immigrant because mm-hmm. she didn't identify that. She's like, hey, I'm here to go to school. Like,
right.
And particularly from, Ecuador. And, she's like, that's who I am. I don't know if I'm going to stay here forever. And when people, I think, Americans and media, right, don't realize that, that is imposing, again, a label that is very loaded and really
Definitely.
Heavy and has a lot of personal decision-making process. I mean, it really caused her to reflect quite a bit, about what was going on, particularly at the time and how she's like, oh my gosh, like, am I secretly an immigrant? Like, do I really want to stay here? You know what I mean? It just created
right.
all this kind of almost trauma.
Absolutely.
And MLB, so right, that effort to tie into, again, a nationalistic, right, type of idea, right, America as the place of immigrants.
Yes.
We're going to use that narrative trope, right, mm-hmm. to show how deserving, how meritocratic,
exactly.
right, they are earning their citizenship by playing baseball. I mean, it is
exactly.
it is absurd, right?
It really is. I mean, sometimes literally because when certain players become U.S. citizens, there's a lot of press coverage around that. Like, I think Aseki Yen became a U.S. citizen after the White Sox won the World Series in 2005. I would need to double check, but I'm pretty sure that was like the reason he finally did it. Because the other thing is, what's ironic about this is because of the kinds of visas that MLB players get, obviously, citizenship still has certain advantages, and according to the players themselves, they're taxed more heavily if they're not citizens. But the fact of the matter is, these are elite, incredibly wealthy transnational men who, not having U.S. citizenship or not having, and not having to worry about where they would be in their legal status process, like an average immigrant would. Like, that's not even on the table. But then, you have these pictures of them. Like, there was a huge thing in all the Chicago media when Ozzy became a citizen. It was like he's there with the flag and the whole thing. And Manny Ramirez, the same thing. He came out to left field right after he became a citizen, holding a little American flag and waving it. And so it's definitely used in that sort of a way to, like you said, they've earned their citizenship, but also, like, I think to just continue to evoke this idea of good immigrants, or to define who's a good immigrant. Like, you're a good immigrant if you can hit the ball out of the ballpark. Like, that's
right.
That's apparently the criteria. Or if you have like 100-mile-an-hour fastball, like Pedro Martinez
right.
or somebody. So,
right.
yes, I mean, but I also, just because of what you were saying, and I think it's so important, the other thing about this idea of using the trope of immigrants, and I think the media in the U.S. is horribly guilty of this, is I think many people who are of Latino heritage are just considered to be immigrants, even if they were born here.
Because
I hear
right.
that from students all the time, too. It's like, no, when people are like, where are you from? They're like, no, I was born in New York City. Like, no, I'm not like from a different country. I was born in, Manhattan or whatever. So yeah, I mean, and I think baseball does little to nothing to dissuade that sort of perception.
Yeah.
And they don't want to. Like, that's the
right.
key. They don't want to. Because my theory is that they would rather a player like someone like David Ortiz, who clearly, or Sammy Sosa for that matter before, who clearly reads as having mostly African heritage and would be understood as Black in the U.S., they would rather that person be read as an immigrant, I think, than as a Black man.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fan base. This is my not totally provable theory, but I think because of the fan base and that MLB has catered to for years, it's better to be, I mean, I hate to say better because I don't think it's better, but I think in MLB, land is considered more, it's considered safer for them, I think, in their like ad campaigns and stuff, to be a good immigrant than to be a Black man who could be perceived as some sort of a threat, which we also see when, because several Black American players, most notably Tori Hunter, have talked about how there are very few Black American, like U.S. Black but not Latino players in MLB anymore. And if you look at the data from the 70s to now, the numbers have flipped. There were a fair amount of U.S.-born Black non-Latino men in the 70s. Now, and not that many from Latin America, now it's the reverse. I mean, it's definitely under 20%. I think at this point it's under 15% of MLB is U.S. Black non-Latino men. So, when Black players make these critiques, like that basically MLB is importing its diversity, MLB, you know, circles the wagons, like that's not it at all. And, you know, comes up with these cockamamie narratives to answer that.
Right. Which, I mean, that's a great point too, to talk about the issue of labor, right, in the MLB. And as it's been pointed out, you know, through its lack of diversity, particularly in regards to African-Americans, that critique is, right, Ben, that the MLB has tried to, you know, import its diversity through the Caribbean, right, and Latin America. And I mean, that fact that, you know, 27%, you know, of MLB, of ball players, right, are from Latin America, predominantly, again, right, the Caribbean and Venezuela. So, I mean, just thoughts on that. I mean, we're getting towards probably the limit of our time. I don't want to keep you too long, but you know, let's talk about the issue of the increasing presence of Latinos and the efforts, right? It's not like this is not just accidental, right?
No. Yeah.
So can you tell us, what has the MLB done, right, to increase, right, the representation of Latin and Latino American ball players?
Yeah, I mean, it's all in the way that they recruit, because every one of the 30 teams now has what they refer to in the Dominican Republic as an academia, which is a baseball academy, where they get young men. I mean, and it's a bit better regulated now than it once was, because the very first academias, and I believe it was your Dodgers that had the first, like, sort of established type of academia in the 70s. And then it sort of mushroomed from there, because teams realized that this was a way to get a lot of cheap labor quickly. And so, you know, there's a very sophisticated recruitment system, but when it was less regulated than it is now, they would get boys that were very young. Like, even now, like, sort of the unspoken word is, if you don't have a team that's really heavily scouting you and interested in you by the time you're 16, you're done, because there's always going to be somebody coming behind you. And, you know, the sort of the labor pool is limitless. And
it's just like shocking, right? I mean, not to cut you off, but shocking, because like in America, right, or in the US, right, you have up until your college years to prove your mettle, right? I mean, it's just, and to think that with the controversy that happened over birth certificates and all that stuff, I mean, a kid can be very promising. And if they find out, you know, that he's not 15 or 16 and he's 17 or 18, they'll just drop him.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's like insane.
17 or 18 is not that old. I mean, we're talking like a year to 2 years, which is what I think just is the most appalling thing. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, and so this, like, and I, you know, another sort of personal, one of the great things about this kind of research is, there were a lot of people who were able to share personal narratives with me that helped to inform this. And a friend of mine who's Dominican, whose family, they're from the Siwao region in the Dominican Republic, and then they settled in Lawrence, Massachusetts, which has a very large Dominican population. And her nephew, like, he had posters of La Santa Trinidad, as I call them, Papi Ortiz and Pedro Martinez and Manny Ramirez on his walls. And in high school, he was like, I want to go back to the Dominican. He and his mother actually were having arguments about this, because he wanted to go back to the Dominican Republic because he really wanted to play baseball and be recruited. But his feeling was that if he stayed in his underfunded urban school district, which had like a very high population of students of color, he wouldn't be scouted. Whereas if he went back to the Dominican Republic, he would have a much better chance of being scouted, which numerically is probably true. I mean, his mother absolutely denied that and put the brakes on it, because she said, you know, if you don't make it, because she's like, I lived in because he came to the U.S. as a child. She's like, look, I lived in the Dominican Republic longer than you did, and I've seen what happens to the many men who don't make it. And then they've dropped out of school. They have, like limited to zero employment prospects. And there's a high poverty rate in the Dominican Republic to begin with. So she's like, that could destroy your life. If you go there, you drop out of school and, you know, maybe you're going to be the one in, you know, a million or whatever who make it. But if you're not, your life is never the same again. And you've made you've done sort of irrevocable damage to your life trajectory. And I think, like, I'll just end this part of the conversation with this. Like, scouts are great because they're not politically correct in any way, shape or form. And they, when scouts were scouting Manning Ramirez back in the late 80s, early 90s, a scout was interviewed and he said, you know, we're only going to Washington Heights, which is, you know, a high Dominican populated neighborhood and considered to be dangerous by like a middle class white guy. He's like, the only reason we're going there is because he's an all city athlete and he's supposedly that good. But honestly, most scouts would rather go to the Dominican Republic because for what we pay one U.S. prospect or even one Puerto Rican prospect, which is why there's sometimes the baseball recruitment in Puerto Rico has gone down because they're part of the U.S. draft now. But the scouts said, you know, for what we pay one U.S. player, we can get at least 10 Dominicans. Why would we not do that? It's just economically makes more sense.
Yeah, it's just, it's, you know, it's hard to hear that. It's hard to read it, right?
Absolutely.
You know, particularly about a sport that you love. And, you know, baseball's not unique in its, you know, approach as, you know, it's a brand, right? It's a brand
Absolutely.
That represents a bunch of corporate interests, right? Each baseball team, right, is run by a multi millionaire, several of them billionaires, right? Mm-hmm. So it is a business, and I think we get that, but it's, guy, just to learn and to read how exploitive it is just quite shocking, you know, and disturbing. And that's not to say that you cover how MLB is being pushed to do better, right? So the system, the academia system that exists now isn't the one that existed in the, you know, 80s or so. But I mean, still, it's still the case that they are banking and profiting off the fact that they've created essentially a pipeline, and they know that they can play off the dreams, right, of, you know, poor folk from the third world. I mean, not third world, but the, you know, the global South, if you will, right? And think like this is their shot. Right. This is their shot. And they're a dime a dozen down there. So, yeah, like you said, it's a lot easier to invest in the development of talent there than it is to go out, you know, scouting, traveling the country, going into so-called bad neighborhoods or scary neighborhoods in the U.S. Because it's not just those aspects, but it's in the end, it's what are they going to pay them in that contract?
Right.
Right. And what are they going to get the return on investment? Right. And that's just going to be the numbers are much more favorable for them. Doing that in the Dominican Republic than it is in the U.S.
Right? Yeah. And unfortunately, the Dominican Republic economically becomes kind of dependent because they do get so much money from this. So they're not as incentivized to do as much to curtail this as maybe they could.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And you talk, and so we don't have to leave it on that, but you go in through the book and you explain what MLB is doing and how they're being pushed to that. And also their, you know, urban, you know, initiatives with Black folk and African Americans and what they're trying to do there. You kind of put these two things together, right, where you're comparing, right, in that sense of like corporate responsibility, et cetera, that kind of frame. And that is a fascinating discussion, so I won't give it all away, but just to let our listeners know, there's a lot more there, and it doesn't necessarily end on that note. But it's important to pull out the, you know, that note of kind of, again, that imperialist, you know, exploitation that has always been a part, you know, of recruiting Latin American, you know, ball players. It still exists to this day, you know, and it makes it, you know, a very uneven, of course, you know, process and divergent process for, you know, those that it works out for and those that it doesn't, right?
Yeah.
Well, I've so much enjoyed our conversation. I mean, one thing I wanted to bring up before we left real quick is just if you could comment to the aspect of, you know, the changing audience of, you know, of Major League Baseball. One thing that made this most clear to me, because one thing is when you're sitting behind a television, you can't quite see the fans as well. You see them full. But going to a game, and particularly for me in my home stadium, you know, Dodger Stadium, I'm just heartbroken. I used to only live just like 8 miles away from it throughout graduate school. It was the closest I ever got to Dodger Stadium and just loved it. I drove by or rode by Dodger Stadium almost every day. But I mean, one thing that shocked me when, you know, as an adult, when I started taking my kids to baseball games, is that the audience is predominantly, easily, far and above Latino than it is, or multiracial than it is anything else, right? And when I grew up going to those games, I mean, my parents took me to my first Dodger game when I was like 6 months old. Of course, I don't remember that, but I think I remember the first one, I was like 6 or 7. I mean, it was almost all white people, right?
Right.
And the Dodgers have their own history, you know, with that and Dodger building of Dodger Stadium and all that stuff. But
yes, Chavez Ravine.
That's actually the shirt I'm wearing. It has the Dodger logo with the ball going through the phrase in Dodger script, the name Chavez Ravine, right?
So, wow, that's perfect.
Yeah, I get a lot of comments or funny looks about this shirt outside of LA. LA, everybody gets it, but
that's where I am now.
Yeah. So, I mean, just that aspect. I mean, so to me, that was just so striking as I started seeing that over and over again, going to games and taking my kids to the game, like thinking like, wow, they are consuming the sport the way I was reading it in a completely different way, in a completely different experience, being surrounded by people that look like them. And this is in LA, so I get this. I don't overblow it, right? And, you know, in Cincinnati, that's probably not the case, right? You know, in other places.
Yeah.
But, you know, the audience itself is diversifying. So, I mean, your thoughts on that, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think like you make a good point. It also depends on the demographics of the city you're in, because there's more Latinos living in LA, period. So one would expect to see more at a Dodger game. It's interesting that you bring this up. I haven't been, because in Chicago, it's a similar thing. You see a very diverse group. The most recent game I've been to was a Sox game not too long ago. And you do see like, yes, all of, like, a little bit of, in Chicago, I would say you see a little bit of everything. It's even more, like, I would say it's even more diverse than it being, like, more predominantly Latinos than other folks of color. What you still, at least sort of anecdotally, I would say, because I haven't looked at attendance data, what you still don't see a super high amount of is Black fans in attendance. Which, and for Chicago, for the White Sox, that's in a very, it's near a very African-American community. And in fact, if anything, now it's gentrifying. So I bet, like, I mean, it's been a while since I've been to Sox Park, but I bet if I went there now, it would be different. It would be a whole different thing. Like, I can remember when the Sox won the World Series in 2005. This is the White Sox. Let me make sure because when I say the Sox, people get confused here in the East Coast. And when they won, I think it was Joe Garagiola was the announcer when like they were about to win the game. And he said, you know, what does this mean for Chicagoans in Bridgeport, who are in this, which is the neighborhood that Sox Park is in, who Italian Americans, Polish Americans, Chinese Americans. And like that area now is like super Latino. There's a lot more of an African-American population. There's an Asian population that's much more diverse because it's adjacent to Chinatown. And so, but his press release, when he described the Sox fan base, sounded like it came from about 1950. I was like, I can't even. So, I mean, so I think we're not seeing MLB's press coverage necessarily catching up with trends in sort of fandom. But I also would say that their initiatives and I'm not sure how successful they are, but every team has Hispanic Heritage Month events. And like, I've been to Sox Park on Latino night, although I will say I thought it would be more interesting than it was. Like, I was like, this is it. Like, they played a few songs. Like, I was like, come on, you can do more. Which, again, it just felt like a very superficial type of attempt to play to and attract more Latino fans. I was like, no, you could do a lot more than this and call this Latino night. But all right. But yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, and I get the sense that it is very much regional in that way. I mean, I do remember, like, going to, it wasn't during Hispanic Heritage Month, so that's too late in the season. It was during the summer, and they were like honoring Fernando Valenzuela, and they had like a mariachi band it was phenomenal. I'll tell you what, they had them playing like 30 minutes before the game, and but even then, it's like the Dodgers for a while, they've been going that direction. I mean, every night's Latino night in stinking LA, you know? So it's very much regional in that way. I mean, it's like you go and you get your helmet full of nachos or your micheladas or whatever, right? It's just like everybody you're around is Latino. There's Mexican flags everywhere. So anyways, it's just, it's a very Mexican sense, I'll say that, right, of Latino, of course, in LA. There's a large, you know, Salvi population there, Salvadoran population.
Yes, absolutely.
But Mexicans, you know, predominate, you know, that market. That city, but anyways, yeah, it's, but you're right. You know, that the absence of, you know, a Black, of an African-American audience, I see that as well. And it's quite frankly, it's heartbreaking. Again, yeah. Right? It's a real missed opportunity.
Especially because baseball, MLB tries to market itself as like this great force in desegregation with the Jackie Robinson case and everything, but that isn't really playing out today at all.
Right. Well, even recently there is the social media campaign, the tip your cap campaign, right?
To
bring awareness to, I think it was the 100-year anniversary of the Negro, mm-hmm. right? And I the same thing I felt there, like they could have just done a lot more. Like, I mean, again, baseball's not on right now, so I'm going to give them a little break, but like it was a different Twitter handle. It was a different mm-hmm. group that started that campaign.
Yeah, like they could do better. They could just do better.
Done way better, you know, particularly since they try to profit so much. You're right, off of Jackie Robinson, off his number, his name, and, mm-hmm. And things of that sort. There's a lot more baseball can do. So
yeah.
Well, wow! I've just completely had so much fun in this conversation. And thank you. Thank you for writing the book. Thank you for coming on the channel and, and giving me the opportunity to talk about baseball.
Thank you. Same here. This has just been a fun conversation. This has just been amazing. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. We'll definitely look forward, and we'll put a link to the book in our post and everything. So
Excellent.
Definitely encourage our audience, baseball fans or not, to check this out. And you also, I will mention, you do a great job of, I think, also covering in several parts the literature on baseball in academia and in other ways too. So there's a lot, to get out of your book there too. It can be used as a sort of roadmap to learn a lot more, and learn more about the literature, even, just beyond how we engage with it. So again, thank you again.
Thank you.